trotted before him, forcing him to go on when he'd rather just go down the hill back to his car. Even that was at least a half-hour walk away. Better to go on after the dog and settle down and then return to the fire. Flossie sniffed at the base of a tree, checked that he was still there, and trotted on. The worst part of the story was that he had allowed Linda to go into the child's room alone. Sitting at the DePizer table, woozy, even more exhausted than he was now, he had sensed that the entire situation was somehow false, that he was unknowingly playing a part in a game. That was what he had not told Otto, that sense of wrongness which had come over him during dinner. Beneath the food's absence of taste had lain the faint taste of garbage, and in the same way beneath the superficial chatter of Florence DePizer had lain something which had made him see himself as a marionette forced into dance. Feeling that, why had he continued to sit, to struggle to appear normal? Why hadn't he taken Linda by the arm and hurried out? Don, too, had said something about feeling like a player in a game. "Because they know you well enough to know what you will do. That is why you stayed. Because they knew you would." The slight wind shifted, turned colder. The hound lifted its nose, sniffed, and turned into the direction of the wind. She began to move more quickly. "Flossie!" he yelled. The hound, already 30 yards ahead of him, and visible only when he saw it coursing between the trees, emerged into an opening and glanced back at Lewis over its shoulder. Then she amazed Lewis by lowering her head and growling. The next second she flashed away. Looking ahead, he saw only the bushy shapes of fir trees, interspersed with the bare skeletons of other trees, standing on ground mottled white. Melting snow moved sluggishly downhill. His feet were cold. Finally, he heard the dog barking and went toward the sound. When he finally saw the dog, she began to whine. She was standing in a small glacial hollow, and Lewis was at the hollow's upper edge. Boulders like Easter Island statues, crusted with quartz, littered the bottom of the hollow. The dog glanced up at him, whined again, wriggled her body, and then flattened out alongside one of the boulders. "Come back, Flossie," he said. The dog pressed herself onto the ground, switching her tail. "What is it?" he asked her. He stepped into the hollow and slipped 2 yards down on cold mud. The dog barked once sharply, then turned in a tight circle and flattened herself out again on the ground. She was looking at a stand of fir trees growing up on the far side of the hollow. As Lewis slogged through the mud, Flossie crept forward toward the trees. "Don't go in there," he said. The dog crept up to the first of the trees, whining. Then it disappeared under the branches. He tried to call it out. The hound would not return. No sound came from within the thick cluster of firs. Frustrated, Lewis looked up at the sky and saw heavy clouds scudding on the north wind. The 2 days' respite from snow was over. "Flossie!" The dog did not reappear, but as he looked at the dense curtain of fir needles, he saw an astonishing thing. Stitched into the pattern of needles and branches was the outline of a door. A clump of dark needles formed the handle. It was the most perfect optical illusion he had ever seen. Even the hinges were represented. Lewis took a step forward. He was at the spot where Flossie had flattened herself out on the ground. The illusion grew more perfect the closer to the trees he went. Now the needles seemed almost to be suggesting the grain of polished wood. It was the way they alternated colors and shades, darker green above lighter, above darker, a random pattern solidifying into the whorls on a slab of monkey wood. It was the door to his bedroom. Lewis slowly went up the other side of the hollow toward the door. He went close enough to touch the smooth wood. It wanted him to open it. Lewis stood in his wet boots in a cold, lifting breeze, and knew that all the inexplicable occurrences of his life since that day in 1929 had led him to this. They put him in front of an impossible door to an unforeseeable experience. If he had just been thinking that the story of Linda's death was, as Don said of the story of Alma Mobley, without point or ending, then there behind the door was its meaning. Even then, Lewis knew that the door led not to one room, but many. Lewis could not refuse it. Otto, rubbing his hands before a twig fire, was only a part of an existence too trivial to insist on its worth, too trivial to hold to. For Lewis, who had already made his decision, his past, especially the latest years in Millburn, was dull lead, a long ache of boredom and uselessness from which he had been shown the way out. Thus Lewis turned the brass knob and fell into his place in the puzzle. He stepped, as he knew he would, into a bedroom. He recognized it immediately, the sunny bedroom filled with Spanish flowers of the ground floor apartment he and Linda had kept in the hotel. A silky Chinese rug stretched beneath his feet to each of the room's corners. Flowers and vases, still hungry for the sun, picked up the golds, reds, and blues of the rug and shone them back. He turned around, saw the closing door, and smiled. Sun streamed through the twin windows. Looking out, he saw a green lawn, a railed precipice, and the top of the steps down to the sea which glimmered below. Lewis went to the canopied bed. A dark blue velvet dressing gown lay folded across its foot. At peace, Lewis surveyed the entire lovely room. Then the door to the lounge opened, and Lewis turned, smiling, to his wife. In the haze of his utter happiness, he moved forward, extending his arms. He stopped when he saw that she was crying. "Darling, what's wrong? What happened?" She raised her hands. Across them lay the body of a short-haired dog. "One of the guests found her lying on the patio. Everybody was just coming out from lunch, and when I got there, they were all standing around staring at the poor little thing. It was horrible, Lewis." Lewis leaned over the body of the dog and kissed Linda's cheek. "I'll take care of it, Linda. But how the devil did it get there?" "They said someone threw it out of a window." "Oh, Lewis, who in the world would do a thing like that?"
"I'll take care of it. Poor sweetie. Just sit down for a minute." He took the corpse of the dog from his wife's hands. "I'll straighten it out. Don't worry about it any more."
"But what are you going to do with it?" she wailed.
"Bury it in the rose garden next to John, I guess."
"That's good. That's lovely."
Carrying the dog, he went toward the lounge door, then paused.
"Lunch went all right otherwise?"
"Yes, fine. Florence DePizer invited us to join her in the suite for dinner tonight. Will you feel like it after all that tennis? You're 65, remember?"
"No, I'm not."
Lewis faced her with a puzzled expression.
"I'm married to you, so I'm 50. You're making me old before my time."
"Absent-minded me," Linda said. "Really, I could just kick myself."
"I'll be right back with a much better idea," Lewis said, and went through the door to the lounge.
The dog's weight slipped off his hands, and everything changed. His father was walking toward him across the floor of the parsonage living room. 2 more points, Lewis. Your mother deserves a little consideration, you know. You treat this house as though it were a hotel. You come in at all hours of the night. His father reached the armchair behind which Lewis stood, swerved off in the direction of the fireplace, and then marched back to the other side of the room, still talking. Sometimes I am told you drink spirits. Now, I am not a prudish man, but I will not tolerate that. I know you are 65. 17, Lewis said. 17, then, don't interrupt. No doubt you think that is very grown up, but you will not drink spirits while you live under this roof. Is that understood? And I want you to begin showing your age by helping your mother with the cleaning. This room is henceforth your responsibility. You must dust and clean it once a week, and see to the grate in the mornings. Is that clear?
Yes, sir, he said.
Good. That is point one. Point two concerns your friends. Mr. James and Mr. Hawthorne are both fine men, and I would say I have an excellent relationship with both of them. But age and circumstance divide us. I would not call them friends, nor would they call me their friend. For one thing, they are Episcopalians, just one step from popery. For another, they possess a good deal of money. Mr. James must be one of the richest men in all of New York. Do you know what that means in 1928?
Yes, sir.
It means that you cannot afford to keep up with his son, nor can you keep up with Mr. Hawthorne's son. We lead respectable and godly lives, but we are not wealthy. If you continue to associate with Sears James and Ricky Hawthorne, I foresee the direst consequences. They have the habits of the sons of wealthy men. As you know, it is my plan to send you to the university in the autumn, but you will be one of the poorest students at Cornell, and you must not learn such habits, Lewis. They will lead only to ruin. I will forever regret your mother's generosity in using her own funds to provide the wherewithal to purchase you a motor car. He was on another circuit of the room. And people are already gossiping about the three of you and that Italian woman on Montgomery Street. I know clergymen's sons are supposed to be wild, but, well, words fail me. He paused midpoint on the track from the corner of the room and looked seriously into Lewis's eyes. I assume that I am understood?
Yes, sir, I understand. Is that all?
No, I am at a loss to account for this. His father was holding out to him the corpse of a short-haired hound. It was lying dead on the walk to the church door. What if one of the congregation had seen it there? I want you to dispose of it immediately.
Leave it to me, Lewis said. I'll bury it in the rose garden.
Please do so immediately.
Lewis took the dog out of the living room and at the last minute turned to ask,
Do you have Sunday's sermon prepared, Father?
No one answered. He was in an unused bedroom at the top of the house on Montgomery Street. The room's only furniture was a bed. The floorboards were bare, and grease paper had been nailed over the only window. Because Lewis's car had a flat tire, Sears and Ricky were off borrowing Warren Scales's old flivver while Warren and his pregnant wife shopped. A woman lay on the bed, but she would not answer him because she was dead. A sheet covered her body. Lewis moved back and forth on the floorboards, willing his friends to return with the farmer's car. He did not want to look at the covered shape on the bed. He went to the window. Through the grease paper, he could see only vague orange light. He glanced back at the sheet.
Linda, he said miserably.
He stood in a metal room with gray metal walls. One light bulb hung from the ceiling. His wife lay under a sheet on a metal table. Lewis leaned over her body and sobbed.
"I won't bury you in the pond," he said. "I'll take you into the rose garden."
He touched his wife's lifeless fingers under the sheet and felt them twitch. He recoiled. As he watched, horrified, Linda's hands crept up beneath the sheet. Her white hands folded the sheet down over her face. She sat up, and her eyes opened. Lewis cowered at the far end of the little room. When his wife swung her legs off the morgue table, he screamed. She was naked, and the left side of her face was broken and scraped. He held his hands out in front of him in a childish gesture of protection. Linda smiled at him and said,
"What about that poor dog?"
She was pointing to the uncovered slab of table where a short-haired hound lay on its side in a puddle of blood. He looked back in horror at his wife, but Stringer Dedham, his hair parted in the middle, a brown shirt concealing his stumps, stood beside him.
"What did you see, Stringer?" he asked.
Stringer smiled at him bloodily.
"I saw you. That's why I jumped out of the window. Don't be a puddin'head."
"You saw me?"
"Did I say I saw you? Guess I'm the puddin'head. I didn't see you. Your wife's the one saw you. What I saw was my girl. Saw her right through her window, morning of the day I helped out on the thresher. Gosh, I must be a real moron."
"But what did you see her doing? What did you try to tell your sisters?"
Stringer bent back his head and laughed, and blood gushed out of his mouth. He coughed.
"Golly gee, I couldn't hardly believe it. It was just amazing, friend. You ever see a snake with its head cut off? You ever see that tongue darting out, and that head just a stump of a thing no bigger than your thumb? You ever see that body working away, beating itself in the dust?"
Stringer laughed loudly through the red foam in his mouth.
"Holy Moses, Lewis, what a godforsaken thing. Honestly, ever since it's been like I can't hardly think straight, like my brain's all mixed up and leaking out of my ears. It's like that time I had the stroke in 1940, remember? When one side of me froze up and you gave me baby food on a spoon. Grr, what a god-awful taste."
"That wasn't you," Lewis said. "That was my father."
"Well, what did I tell you? It's all mixed up, like someone cut my head off and my tongue keeps moving."
Stringer gave an abashed red smile.
"Say, wasn't you going to take that poor old dog and drop it in the pond?"
"Oh, yes, when they get back," Lewis said. "We need Warren Scales' car. His wife is pregnant."
"The wife of a Roman Catholic farmer is of no concern to me at the moment," his father said. "One year at college has coarsened you, Lewis."
From his temporary mooring beside the mantel, he looked long and sadly at his son.
"And I know, too, that this is a coarsening era. Pitch defileth, Lewis. Our age is pitch. We are born into damnation, and for our children all is darkness. I wish that I could have reared you in more stable times. Lewis, once this country was a paradise. A paradise! Fields as far as you could see, filled with the bounty of the Lord. Son, when I was a boy, I saw scripture in the spider webs. The Lord was watching us then, Lewis. You could feel his presence in the sunlight and the rain. But now we are like spiders dancing in a fire."
He looked down at the literal fire, which was warming his knees.
"It all started with the railway. That I'm sure of, son. The railroad brought money to men who'd never had the smell of $2 together in all their lives. The iron horse spoiled the land. And now financial collapse is going to spread like a stain over this whole country."
And looked at Lewis with the clear, shrewd eyes of Sears James.
I promised her I'd bury her in the rose garden, Lewis said. They'll be back with the car soon.
The car! His father turned away in disgust. You never listened to the important things I had to tell you. You have forsaken me, Lewis.
You excite yourself too much, Lewis said. You'll give yourself a stroke.
His will be done.
Lewis looked at his father's rigid back.
I'll see to it now.
His father made no answer.
Goodbye.
His father spoke without turning around.
You never listened. But mark me, son, it will come back to haunt you. You were seduced by yourself, Lewis. Nothing sadder can be said of any man. A handsome face and feathers for brains. You got your looks from your mother's Uncle Leo, and when he was 25, he stuck his hand into the wood stove and held it there until it was charred like a hickory log.
Lewis went through the dining room door. Linda was peeling the sheet off her naked body in the vacant upper room. She smiled at him with bloody teeth.
After that, she said, your mother's Uncle Leo was a godly man all his life long.
Her eyes glowed, and she swung her legs down off the bed. Lewis backed away toward the bare wooden wall.
After that, he saw scripture in spider webs, Lewis.
She moved slowly toward him, twisting on a broken hip.
You were going to put me in the pond. Did you see scripture in the pond, Lewis? Or were you distracted by your pretty face?
Now it's over, isn't it? Lewis asked.
Yes.
She was close enough for him to catch the dark brown smell of death. Lewis straightened his body against the rough wall.
What did you see in that girl's bedroom?
I saw you, Lewis. What you were supposed to see. Like this.
9. As long as Peter was concealed by the underbrush, he was safe. A wiry network of branches hid him from the road. On the other side, beginning 10 or 15 yards back, were trees like those before Lewis's house. Peter worked his way back into them to be further screened from the man in the car. The Jehovah's Witness had not moved off the shoulder of the highway. Peter could see the top of his car, a bright acrylic blue shield over the top of the dry brambles. Peter ducked from the safety of one tree to another, then to another. The car inched forward. They continued in this way for some time, Peter moving slowly over the damp ground and the car clinging to his side like a shark to which he was the pilot fish. At times, the witness's car moved slightly ahead. At times, it hung back, but never was it more than 5 or 10 yards off in either direction. The only comfort available for Peter was that the driver's errors proved that he could not see him. He was just idling down the shoulder of the road, waiting for a section of cleared ground. Peter tried to visualize the landscape on his side of the highway, and remembered that only for a mile or so in the vicinity of Lewis's house was there heavy ground cover. Most of the rest of the land, until an eruption of gas stations and drive-ins marked the edges of Milburn, was field. Unless he crawled in ditches for 7 miles, the man in the car would be able to see him as soon as he left the stretch of woods.
Come out, son.
The witness was aimlessly sending out messages, trying to coax him into the car. Peter shut his mind to the whispers as well as he could and plunged on through the woods. Maybe, if he kept on running, the witness would drive down the road far enough to let him think.
Come on, boy. Come out of there. Let me take you to her.
Still protected by the high brambles and the trees, Peter ran until he could see, strung between the massive trunks of oaks, double strands of silvery wire. Beyond the wire was a long curved vacancy of field, empty, white ground. The witness's car was nowhere in sight. Peter looked sideways,
but here the trees were too thick and the brambles too high for him to see the section of highway nearest him. Peter reached the last of the trees and the wire and looked over the field, wondering if he could get across unseen. If the man saw him on the field, Peter knew he would be helpless. He could run, but eventually the man would get him, as the thing back in the Montgomery Street house got Jim.
"She's interested in you, Peter."
It was another aimless, haphazard dart with no real urgency in it.
"She'll give you everything you want. She'll give you anything you want. She'll give you back your mother."
The blue car edged forward into his vision and stopped just past the point where the field began. Peter shuddered back a few feet deeper into the wood. The man in the car turned sideways, resting his arm along the top of the seat, and in this posture of patient waiting, looked out at the field Peter would have to cross.
"Come on out, and we'll give you your mother."
Yes, that was what they would do. They'd give him back his mother. She would be like Jim Hardy and Freddie Robinson, with empty eyes and amnesiac conversation and no more substance than a ray of moonlight. Peter sat down on wet ground, trying to remember if any other roads were near. He would have to go through the woods, or the man would find him when he crossed the field. Was there another road, running parallel to the highway, going back to Milburn? He remembered nights of driving around the countryside with Jim, all of the footloose journeying of high school weekends and summers. He would have said that he knew Broome County as well as he knew his own bedroom. But the patient man in the blue car made it difficult to think. He could not remember what happened on the other side of this wood. A developer's suburb, a factory? For a moment, his mind would not give him the information he knew it had, and instead offered images of vacant buildings where dark things moved behind drawn blinds. But whatever lay on the other side of the woods, the other side was where he had to go. Peter stood up quietly and retreated a few yards farther into the woods before turning his back on the highway and running away from the car. Seconds later, he remembered what he was running toward. There was an old two-lane macadam highway in this direction, in Milburn, called the Old Binghamton Road, because once it had been the only highway between the two towns. Pitted, obsolete, and unsafe, it was avoided by nearly all traffic now. Once there had been small businesses dotted along it, fruit markets, a motel, a drugstore. Now most of these were empty, and some of them had been razed. The Bay Tree Market alone flourished. It was heavily patronized by the better-off people of Milburn. His mother had always bought fruit and vegetables there. If he remembered the distance between the old and the new highways correctly, it would take him less than 20 minutes to get to the market. From there, he could get a lift into town and make it safely to the hotel. In 15 minutes, he had wet feet, a stitch in his side, and a rip in his jacket from a snagged branch, but he knew he was getting near the old road. The trees had thinned out, and the ground sloped gently down. Now, seeing in the blank gray air ahead of him that the woods were ending, he went nearer the fence and crept slowly along it for the final 30 yards. He still was not sure if the fruit market was to the left or the right, or how far off it was. All he hoped was that it would be in sight and show a busy parking lot. He squelched forward, peering around the few remaining trees.
"You're wasting your time, Peter. Don't you want to see your mother again?"
He groaned, feeling the feathery touch of the witness's mind. His stomach went cold. The blue car was parked on the road before him. On the front seat, Peter saw a bulky shape he knew was the witness, leaning back, waiting for him to show himself. The Bay Tree Market was in sight, about a quarter mile down the old highway to Peter's left. The car faced the other way.
If he made a run for it, the man would have to turn his car around on the narrow old road. That still would not give him enough time. Peter looked again at the market. There were plenty of cars in the lot. At least one of them would belong to someone he knew. All he had to do was to get there. For a moment, he felt no more than 5 years old, a shivering boy, helpless, and with no weapons and with no hope of defeating the murderous creature waiting for him in the car. If he tore his windbreaker into pieces and then tied them together and then put one end in the gas tank, but that was just a bad idea from worse movies. He could never get to the car before the man saw him. In fact, the only thing he could do, apart from rushing the man, was to go openly across the field to the market and see what happened. The man was looking the other way, and at least he would have some time before he was seen. Peter separated the strands of wire clipped to the trees and climbed through. A quarter of a mile away, in a straight line, was the rear parking lot of the Bay Tree Market. He held his breath and started walking across the field. The car did a three-point turn behind him and drew up alongside him, just visible in the periphery of his vision.
"Nice brave boy. Nice boys shouldn't go hitchhiking, should they?"
Peter closed his eyes and went stumbling over the field.
"Stupid brave boy."
He wondered what the man would do to stop him. He did not have to wait long to find out.
"Peter, I have to talk to you. Open your eyes, Peter."
The voice was Louis Benedict's. Peter opened his eyes and saw Louis standing 20 yards before him, dressed in baggy trousers, boots, an unfastened khaki army jacket.
"You're not here," Peter said.
"Talk sense, Peter," Louis said, and began to come toward him. "You can see me, can't you? You can hear me. I'm here. Please listen to me. I want to tell you about your mother."
"She's dead."
Peter stopped walking, unwilling to get closer to the Louis creature.
"No, she is not."
Louis stopped too, as if not wishing to frighten Peter. Off on the road to their side, the car also halted.
"Nothing's that black or white. She wasn't dead when you saw her in my house, was she?"
"She was."
"You can't be sure, Pete. She passed out, just like you."
Louis opened his hands and smiled at Peter.
"No, they cut open her throat. They killed her, just like those animals were killed."
He closed his eyes again.
"Pete, you're wrong, and I can prove it. That man in the car doesn't want to hurt you. Let's go to him. Let's go there now."
Peter opened his eyes.
"Did you really sleep with my mother?"
"People our age sometimes make mistakes. They do things they're sorry about later. But it didn't mean anything, Pete. You'll see when you get home. All you have to do is come home with us, and she'll be there just like she always is."
Louis was smiling toward him with intelligent concern.
"Don't judge her badly because she made one mistake."
He started coming forward again.
"Trust me. I always hoped we'd be friends."
"I did too. But you can't be my friend because you're dead," Peter said.
He bent over and picked up a double handful of wet snow. He squeezed it together in his hands.
"You're going to throw a snowball at me? Isn't that a little juvenile?"
"I feel sorry for you," Peter said,
and threw the snowball and blew the thing that looked like Louis into a shower of falling light. As if shell-shocked, he trudged ahead, walking straight through the space where Louis had stood. The air tingled on his face. He felt another feathery tickling in his mind and braced himself. But no words followed. Instead came a wave of bitterness and anger, which nearly knocked him down with its force. It was the same blackness of feeling he had seen when the creature holding his mother had taken off its dark glasses, and the violence of the emotion made him stagger. But there was a wide current of defeat in it. Peter snapped his head sideways in surprise. The blue car accelerated down the macadam road. Relief buckled his knees. He did not know why, but he had won. Peter sat heavily, clumsily, down in the snow and tried not to cry. After a while, he stood up again and continued on toward the parking lot. He was too numb for feeling. He made himself concentrate on getting his legs to move, first one step, then another. His feet were very cold. Another step. Now he was not far from the lot. Then an even greater sweetness flooded through him. His mother was flying through the parking lot, running toward him. "Pete!" she shouted, half-sobbing. "Thank God!" She reached the cars at the edge of the lot and ran past them onto the field. He stood watching her run toward him, too crowded with feeling to speak, and then trudged forward. She had a large bruise on one cheek, and her hair was as tangled as a gypsy's. A scarf tied around her neck showed a line of red at its center.
"You got away," he said,
stupefied with relief.
"They took me out of the house. That man."
She stood a few yards away from him, and her hands went to her throat.
"He cut my neck. I fainted. I thought they were going to kill you."
"I thought you were dead," he told her.
"Oh, Mom, poor Pete."
She hugged her arms around herself.
"Let's get out of here. We'll have to get a ride back to town. I guess both of us can just about move that far."
That she could joke, however feebly, moved him again to the point of tears. He put a hand over his eyes.
"Cry later," she said. "I think I'll cry for a week after I sit down. Let's find a ride."
"How did you get away from them?" He walked beside her, about to hug her, but she stepped backward, leading him toward the lot. He fell into step with her.
"I guess they thought I was too frightened to move. And when they got me outside, the fresh air sort of revived me. That man relaxed his hold on my arm, and I swung around and belted him with my bag. Then I ran away into the woods. I heard them looking for me. I've never, never been so scared in my life. After a while, they just gave up. Were they looking for you?"
"No," he said. "No," and the tension melted in him. "There was someone else, but he left. He didn't get me."
"They'll leave us alone now," she said. "Now that we're away from there."
He looked into her face, and she glanced down.
"I owe you a lot of explanations, Peter, but this isn't the time. I just want to get home and put a real bandage on my throat. We'll have to think of something to tell your father."
"You won't tell him what happened?"
"We'll just let it die, can't we?" she asked, and looked pleadingly at him. "I'll explain everything to you, in time. Let's just be thankful now that we're alive."
They stepped onto the surface of the parking lot.
"Okay," Peter said. "Mom, I'm so..."
He struggled with his emotions, but they were too dense to be expressed.
"We have to talk to someone, though. The same man that hurt you killed Jim Hardy."
She looked back at him, having walked forward toward the crowded middle of the lot.
"I know."
"You know?
I mean, I guessed. Hurry up, Pete. My neck hurts. I want to get home."
"You said you knew." She made a gesture of exasperation.
"Don't cross-examine me, Peter."
Peter looked wildly around the parking lot and saw the blue car just nosing past the side of the market.
"Oh, Mom," he said. "They did. They did. You didn't get away from them."
"Peter, snap out of it. I see someone we can get a ride with." As the blue car swung up the lane behind her, Peter walked toward his mother, staring at her.
Okay, I'm coming.
Good, Peter. Everything will be the way it was again. You will see. We both had a terrible fright, but a hot bath and a good sleep will work wonders.
You'll need stitches in your neck, Peter said, coming closer.
No, of course not, she smiled at him. A bandage is all I need. It was just a scratch, Peter.
What are you doing, Peter?
Don't touch it. It hurts. You'll start the bleeding again.
The blue car was now at the top of their row. Peter reached out toward his mother.
Don't, Pete. We'll get our ride in a minute.
He clamped his eyes shut and swung his arm toward his mother's head. A second later, his fingers were tingling. He yelled. A horn sounded, terrifyingly loud. When he opened his eyes, his mother was gone, and the blue car was speeding toward him. Peter scrambled toward the protection of two parked cars and slipped between them just as the blue car raced by, scraping its side against them and making them rock. He watched it squeeze down to the end of the aisle, and when it cut across to drive up the next aisle, he saw Ermengarde Drager, Penny's mother, walk out of the back door of the market carrying a sack of groceries. He ran toward her, cutting through the rows of parked cars. Stories 10 Inside the hotel, Mrs. Hardy looked at him curiously, but told him Don Wanderley's room number, and then watched him as he climbed the steps at the end of the lobby. He knew that he should have turned around to say something, but he could not trust himself, after the strain of riding back to town with Mrs. Drager, to make even the most perfunctory conversation with Jim's mother. He found Don's door and knocked.
"Mr. Wanderley," he said when the rider opened the door.
For Don, the appearance of the shaken teenager outside his room meant the arrival of certainty. The period when the consequences of the final Chowder Society story, whatever that would turn out to be, were limited to its members and a few outliers, was over. The expression of shock and loss on Peter Barnes's face told Don that what he had been brooding about in his room was no longer the property of himself and four elderly men.
"Come in, Peter," he said. "I thought we'd be meeting again soon."
The boy moved like a zombie into the room and sat blindly in a chair.
"I'm sorry," he began, and then closed his mouth. "I have to..."
He blinked, and was obviously unable to continue.
"Hang on," Don said,
and went to his dresser and took out a bottle of whiskey. He poured an inch into a water glass and gave it to Peter.
"Drink some of this and settle down.
Then just tell me everything that happened. Don't waste time thinking that I might not believe you, because I will. And so will Mr. Hawthorne and Mr. James when I tell them."
"My older friends," Peter said.
He swallowed some of the whiskey.
"That's what he called them. He said you thought his name was Greg Benton."
Peter twitched, uttering the name, and Don felt the shock of a conviction hitting his nerves. Whatever the danger to himself, he would destroy Greg Benton.
"You met him," he said.
"He killed my mother," Peter said flatly. "His brother held me and made me watch. I think they drank her blood, like they did to those animals. And he killed Jim Hardy. I saw him do it, but I got away."
"Go on," Don said.
"And he said someone, I can't remember his name, would call him a Manitou. Do you know what that is?"
"I've heard of it."
Peter nodded, as if this satisfied him.
"And he turned into a wolf. I saw him do it."
Peter set the glass down on the floor, then looked at it again, and picked it up and took another sip. His hands trembled badly enough to nearly splash the whiskey over the lip of the glass.
"They stink. They're like rotten dead things. I had to scrub and scrub.
where Finney touched me.
You saw Benton turn into a wolf?
Yes. Well, no, not exactly. He took off his glasses. They have yellow eyes. He let me see him. He was nothing but hate and death. He was like a laser beam.
I understand, Don said. I've seen him, but I never saw him without his glasses.
When he takes them off, he can make you do things. He can talk inside your head like ESP. And they can make you see dead people, ghosts. But when you touch them, they sort of blow up.
But they don't blow up. They grab you and they kill you.
But they're dead, too. Somebody else owns them. Their benefactor. They do what she wants.
She? Don asked, and remembered a lovely woman holding this handsome boy's chin at her dinner party.
That Anna Mostyn, Peter said. But she was here before.
Yes, she was, Don said, as an actress. Peter looked at him with grateful surprise. I just figured out some of the story, Peter, Don said, just in the past few days. He looked at the shivering boy in the chair. It looks like you figured out a lot more than I did, and in a shorter time.
He said he was me, Peter said, his face distorting. He said he was me. I want to kill him.
Then we'll do it together, Don said. They're here because I'm here, Don told him. Ricky Hawthorne said that when I joined him and Sears and Louis Benedict, that we brought these things, these beings, into focus, that we gathered them here. Maybe if I had stayed away, there'd just be a few dead sheep or cows or something, and that would be that. But that was never a possibility, Peter. I couldn't stay away, and they knew I would have to come. And now they can do anything they want. Peter interrupted him.
Anything she wants them to do.
That's right. But we're not helpless. We can fight back. And we'll do it. We'll get rid of them however we can. That's a promise.
But they're already dead, Peter said. How can we kill them? I know they're dead. They have that smell.
He was beginning to slide into panic again, and Don reached over and touched his hand. I know because of the stories. These things aren't new. They've probably been around for centuries. For longer than that. They've certainly been talked about and written about for hundreds of years. I think they are what people used to call vampires and werewolves. They're probably behind 1,000 ghost stories. Well, in the stories, and I think that means in the past, people found ways to make them die again. Stakes through the heart or silver bullets. Remember? The point is that they can be destroyed. And if it takes silver bullets, that's what we'll use. But I don't think we'll need them. You want revenge, and I do too, and we'll get it.
But that's just them, Peter said, looking straight at Don. What do we do about her?
That'll be harder. She's the general. But history is full of dead generals. It was a facile answer, but the boy seemed calmer. Now, I think you'd better tell me everything, Peter. Begin with how Jim died, if that's the beginning. The more you remember, the more you'll help us. So try to tell it all. Why didn't you tell anyone else about this? He asked when Peter was done.
Because I knew no one would believe me but you. You heard the music.
Don nodded.
And nobody will they? They'll think it's like Mr. Scales and the Martians.
Not quite. The Chowder Society will, I hope.
You mean Mr. James and Mr. Hawthorne and...
Yes. He and the boy looked at each other,
knowing that Lewis was dead.
"We'll be enough, Peter. It's the four of us against her."
"When do we start? What do we do?"
"I'll meet with the others tonight. I think you ought to go home. You have to see your father."
"He won't believe me. I know he won't. Nobody would unless they..."
The boy's voice trailed off.
"Do you want me to come with you?"
Peter shook his head.
"I will if you want me to."
"No. I won't tell him. It wouldn't do any good. I'll have to tell him later."
"Maybe that's better. And if you want help when the time comes, I'll give it to you, Peter. I think you've been brave as hell. Most adults would have folded up like tissue paper. But you're going to have to be even braver from now on. You might have to protect your father as well as yourself. Don't open your door to anybody unless you know who they are." Peter nodded.
"I won't. You bet I won't. But why are they here anyhow? Why is she here?"
"That's what I'm going to find out tonight."
Peter stood up and began to leave, but when he put his hands in his pockets, he touched a folded pamphlet.
"I forgot. The man in the blue car gave me this after he took me to Mr. Benedict's house."
He brought out the watchtower and smoothed it out on Don's desk. Beneath the name, in large black letters on the cheap pulpy paper, were the words, "Dr. Rabbitfoot led me to sin." Don ripped the pamphlet in half. 11. Harold Sims tramped into the upper woods, disgusted with both himself and Stella Hawthorne. His shoes and the bottoms of his trousers were soaked, the shoes probably ruined. But what was not? He had lost his job, and when he had finally asked Stella to leave with him, after weeks of thinking about it, he had lost her too. Damn it! Did she think that he had just asked her on the spur of the moment? Didn't she know him better than that? He ground his teeth. "It's not like I forgot she was 60," he told himself. "I worried about that plenty. I came to that bitch with clean hands," he said out loud, and saw the words vaporize before him. She had betrayed him. She had insulted him. She had never, he could see it now, really taken him seriously. And what was she, anyhow? An old bag with no morals and a freakish bone structure? Intellectually, she hardly counted. And she wasn't really adaptable. Look at her view of California. Trailer parks and taco burgers. She was shallow. Milburn was where she belonged, with that stuffy little husband talking about old movies. "Yes?" he said. He had heard a quick, gasping noise very near. "Do you need help?" No one answered, and he put his hands on his hips and looked around. It had been a human noise, a sound of pain. "I'll help you if you tell me where you are," he said. Then he shrugged and walked toward the area where he thought the sound had come from. He stopped as soon as he saw the body lying at the base of the fir trees. It was a man, what was left of a man. Sims forced himself to look at him. That was a mistake, for he nearly vomited. Then he realized that he would have to look again. His ears were roaring. Sims bent over the battered head. It was, as he had feared, Lewis Benedict. Near his head was the body of a dog. At first, Sims had thought that the dog was a severed piece of Lewis. Trembling, Sims straightened up. He wanted to run. Whatever kind of animal had done that to Lewis Benedict was still nearby. It couldn't be more than a minute away. Then he heard crashing in the bushes and was too scared to move. He visualized some huge animal leaping out at him from behind the firs, a grizzly. Sims opened his mouth, but nothing came out. A man with a face like a Halloween pumpkin emerged from around the fir trees. He was breathing hard, and he held a huge blunderbuss of a shotgun pointed at Sim's belly.
"Hold it there," the man said.
Sims was certain that the frightening-looking creature was going to blow him in half and his bowels voided.
"I ought to kill you stone dead right now," the man said. "Please. But this is your lucky day, killer. I am taking you to a telephone and getting the police to come. Eh? Why did you do this to Lewis, eh?"
When Sims could not answer, understanding only that this horrible peasant would not kill him after all, Otto inched around behind him and prodded him in the back with the barrels of the shotgun.
"So, play soldier, Scheißkopf, march, mach schnell!"
Ancient History 12 Don waited in his car outside Edward Wanderley's house for Sears and Ricky to arrive. Waiting, he found in himself all the emotions he had seen in Peter Barnes that evening. But the boy was a rebuke to his fear. Over a few days, Peter Barnes had done and understood more than he and his uncle's friends had in more than a month. Don lifted the two books he had taken from the Milburn Library just before Peter had come. They supported the notion he'd had while talking to the three men in Sears's library. He thought he knew what they were fighting. Sears and Ricky would tell him why. Then, if their story fit his theory, he would do what they had asked him to Milburn for. He would give them their explanation. And if the explanation seemed lunatic, perhaps it was. Perhaps it was even wrong. But Peter's story and the copy of The Watchtower proved that they had long since lurched into a time when madness offered a truer picture of events than sanity. If his mind and Peter Barnes's had shattered, Milburn had shattered to their pattern. And out of the cracks had crawled Gregory and Fenny and their benefactor, all of whom they must destroy. "Even if it kills us," Don thought. "Because we are the only ones who have a chance of doing it." The headlights of a car appeared in a swirl of falling snow. After a moment, Don saw the outline of a high, dark car behind them, and the car swung to the curb on the other side of Haven Lane. The lights died. First Ricky, then Sears, got out of the old black Buick. Don left his own car and trotted across the street to join them.
"And now, Lewis," Ricky said to him, "did you know?"
"Not definitely, but I thought so." Sears, who had been listening to this, nodded impatiently.
"You thought so. Ricky, give him the keys."
As Don opened the door, Sears grumbled behind him,
"I hope you'll tell us how you got your information. If Hardesty fancies himself as the town crier, I'll arrange to have him spitted."
The three men went into a black entryway. Sears found the light switch.
"Peter Barnes came to me this afternoon," Don said. "He saw Gregory Bate kill his mother, and he saw what must have been Lewis's ghost."
"Oh, God," Ricky breathed. "Oh, my God. Oh, poor Christina."
"Let's get the heat going before we say any more," Sears requested. "If everything's blowing up in our faces, I, for one, at least want to be warm."
The three of them began wandering through the ground floor of the house, lifting dust sheets off the furniture.
"I will miss Lewis very much," Sears said. "I used to malign him terribly, but I did love him. He gave us spirit. As your uncle did."
He dropped a dust sheet on the floor.
"And now he is in the Shenango County morgue, apparently the victim of a savage attack by some sort of animal. A friend of Lewis's accused Harold Sims of the crime. Under different circumstances, that would be comic.
Sears' face sagged.
Let's take a look at your uncle's office, and then take care of the heating. I don't know if I can bear this anymore.
Sears led him into a large room at the rear of the house, while Ricky switched on the central heating boiler.
This was the office.
He flicked a switch, and track lights on the ceiling shone on an old leather couch, a desk with an electric typewriter, a file cabinet, and a Xerox machine. On a broad shelf jutting out below narrower shelves, filled with white boxes, set a reel-to-reel tape recorder and a cassette recorder.
The boxes are the tapes he made for his books?
I guess so.
And you and Ricky and the others never came here after he died?
No, Sears said, gazing at the well-ordered office. It evoked Don's uncle more wholly than any photograph. It radiated the contentment of a man happy in what he did. This impression helped to explain Sears's next words.
I suppose that Stella told you we were afraid to come in here. There might be some truth in that. But I think that what really kept us away was guilt.
And that was part of the reason you invited me to Millburn.
Yes. I think all of us, except Ricky, thought you would...
He made a shooing away gesture with his hands.
Somehow magically dispel our guilt. John Jaffrey most of all. That is the wisdom of hindsight.
Because it was Jaffrey's party.
Sears nodded curtly and turned out of the office. There still must be most of a cord of wood out in back. Why don't you bring some of it in so we can have a fire?
This is the story we never thought we'd tell, Ricky said 10 minutes later.
A bottle of old Par and their glasses stood on the dusty table before Ricky's couch.
That fire was a good idea. It'll give Sears and me something to look at. Did I ever tell you that I started everything by asking John about the worst thing he'd ever done? He said he wouldn't tell me. And he told me a ghost story instead. Well, I should have known better. I knew what the worst thing was. We all knew.
Then why did you ask? Ricky sneezed violently, and Sears said,
It happened in 1929, October of 1929. That was a long time ago. When Ricky asked John about the worst thing he'd ever done, all that we could think about was your Uncle Edward. It was only a week after his death. Eva Galley was the last thing on our minds.
Well, now we have truly crossed the Rubicon, said Ricky. Up until you said the name, I still wasn't sure that we'd tell it. But now that we're here, we'd better go on without stopping. Whatever Peter Barnes told you had better wait until we're done. If, after that, you still want to stay in the same room with us. And I suppose that somehow what happened to him must be related to the Eva Galley affair. Now, I've said it too.
Ricky never wanted you to know about Eva Galley, said Sears. Way back when I wrote to you, he thought it would be a mistake to rake it all up again. I guess we agreed with him. I certainly did.
Thought it would muddy the waters, Ricky said through his cold. Thought it wouldn't possibly have anything to do with our problem. Spook stories, nightmares, premonitions, just four old fools losing their marbles. Thought it was irrelevant. It was all so mixed up anyhow. Should have known better when that girl came looking for a job. And now, with